Wow, that is really good. That was my reaction when Hans Reitzebauer poured the latest version of his Poor William for me, and then he told me that he considers this most recent Poor William to be one of his finest releases ever. That's saying a lot because of everything Hans Reitzebauer does, and the quality is great across the board. It's the fruit distillates that are really superb. I know the big stumbling block in the market for this sort of distillate is that people don't think they'll drink much of the stuff. But let me ask you a question. If you were to drink some Poor William, wouldn't you want it to be the best that is possibly out there? I mean, if you're only going to drink a small amount, shouldn't that small amount be really excellent? It should, right? Right? Or else what's the point of even trying it at all? Well, I have a great chance for you to provide yourself with the good stuff. The nice folks at Crush Wine and Spirits are offering a discount on the Hans Reitzebauer Poor William so that the price for podcast listeners is a good chunk off of the normal. If you give Crush a special offer code, you can get a half bottle of the really tremendous Reitzebauer Poor William for $61.95 instead of the usual $67.95, and that's 10% off. You just need to call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTT for me, or use that same offer code online at crushwineco.com. Remember to tell Crush IDTTFORME when it comes time to place the order. Hans Reitzebauer is one of the greatest living distillers on the planet today. To try some of his best work ever, call Crush Wine and Spirits and ask for the special deal available to podcast listeners. Recently, I attended a tasting of small grower coffees sourced by Damour, a micro roaster that specializes in finding and shipping rare, high-quality coffee beans from around the world. I was so impressed by the scope of the Damour project that I spoke with founder Jennifer Stone about the lengths she goes to preserve the quality of the coffee beans she purchases for roasting.
The first thing I'm looking for is things gone wrong, defects. So, moldy bean, rotten bean, sour bean, something called a Quaker, which is a bean that just never develops. All those things can give the cup an off note. So, that's what I'm looking for first off. A lot of things can go wrong from the farmer can do an amazing job picking the coffee, processing it, bagging it, and then it can go off to the, it goes to the mill, then it goes to dock, basically jumps on a container and floats to wherever, whoever's purchased it. And things can happen, like if the container ship isn't leaving that day that he expects it to, and it can just sit in the hot sun. So you can taste that when it gets here. So, the coffee level that I deal with, you would never find that. Specialty grade is the top grade of coffee. That's green coffee beans, raw coffee beans that have zero defects per 350 grams. And a defect is, again, that stick stone, moldy bean, rotten bean, fungus, excessive bug bites. A lot of beans can get crushed in the process. And so if there's too many of those, it affects the cup quality. And then we go down to premium grade, which is really more ubiquitous. It's probably what you're seeing around the city quite a bit. In that grade, you're allowed to have two defects. And then you have exchange grade, below grade, off grade. So those are still what we call Arabica coffee, which is the species. And you'll hear that used a lot in
A lot.
marketing.
Yeah,
Yeah,
you hear that a
it's
lot.
Arabica. But that doesn't mean it's good. It just means it's grown at a certain altitude or it's a certain species of coffee. So what I've done with this new line we're talking about, Damour, is taking that specialty standard and really created my own set of higher standards that encompass the quality level. Things like, altitude and variety are important. But for me, I'm looking for complexity of flavor first and foremost. Coffee that has a distinct taste to anyone should be able to taste these distinctions, the beginning, the middle, the end, and then an aftertaste. And then I'm also looking for an inherent sweetness that through our particular roasting style, we can highlight. It's really the benchmarks of Cafe Privé Select.
To find out more details about Damour and to purchase small lot, high quality roasted beans for your own use, go to damourcoffee.com. That's damourcoffee.com. DemourCoffee.com. And experience a whole new world of coffee. I'll drink to that, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
Are you guys ready to get warmed up? Because I am.
Chemistry views state changes through the scientific method, rather than through morally charged interpretations. while at Alchemy Center was the idea that ignoble and basic materials could transform into better states. Lead into gold, spices and fruits into spirits that could heal. The ability to transform corrupted, imperfect materials into unflawed and perfect materials often had double meanings and alluded that people could also go from imperfect states to states of enlightenment and even immortality. Alchemy finds its roots in Egyptian metallurgy, and throughout history has had its ups and downs in the public eye. In the early 100s, alchemist ideas coexisted with several religious ideologies, but by the 1200s, early writers of literature, Dante and Chaucer, depicted alchemists as thieves and liars. But by the 1600s, a few founders of modern science, including Boyle and Isaac Newton, were heavily interested in alchemy. Alchemy was slightly interwoven with religion, and several alchemists of this period believed that certain concoctions could facilitate communication with angels. And during the Renaissance, many rich patrons employed alchemists for chemicals, medicines, and mining operations. One goal of alchemy was to find an elixir that could yield eternal life or immortality. And several recipes for alcohol-based medicines still survive today. Making brandy and steeping spices and fruits in it, sometimes being redistilled, made all sorts of flavored spirits that were meant to alleviate this or that ailment. Distillation was seen as a means of purification, of turning an imperfect item that was bound to decay into a stable, potentially immortal substance of pure quality. By consuming the purer forms of spices, fruits, and vegetables, an entire medicinal framework arose around these alchemy elixirs. In the mid-1900s, H.J. Shepard wrote, "Alchemy is the art of liberating parts of the cosmos from temporal existence and achieving perfection, which for metals is gold, and for man, longevity, then immortality, and finally, redemption. Material perfection was sought through the action of a preparation, a philosopher's stone for metals, and the elixir of life for humans, while spiritual ennoblement resulted from some form of inner revelation or other enlightenment." Today, the distillation of spirits is a much more scientific and secular business. The chemistry of alcohol and distillation is well understood, and the drinking of spirits is a highly secular activity that revolves around entertainment and social life more than medicine and spirituality. However, sometimes, when you try some of the world's finest spirits, you wonder about the possibilities of an elixir that can lead you toward a higher state of being.
I'm Mike Martin, wine director for Vinci Fine Wines in New York City, New York.
Christy Frank, Frankly Wines.
Jason Wagner, Feng Tu Restaurant.
Patrick Watson, Back Label Wine Merchants.
Raj Vaidya, Restaurant Danielle.
Jack Mason, Marcha Restaurant.
Jessica Brown, wine director at the Breslin Bar and Dining Room and the John Dory Oyster Bar.
I've told you many times how great 750 is, but don't just take it from me. There are many, many buyers who are using 750 to make their lives easier every day. With access to detailed wholesale pricing, a calendar of upcoming trade tastings, and seamless connections to their sales reps. Check out 750.com for yourself and get signed up. Hans Reisenbauer on the show from Augsburg in Austria. Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Nice to have you here.
Thank you that I come here.
So you're in Upper Austria. What's that region like?
Upper Austria is a typical agricultural region, and with no wine, but we have a lot of places for good fruits.
So it's really not a wine region?
No, not a wine region. Now two or three people start to making wine, but the world don't need this wine.
So you are obliged to do something else?
Yes.
Even though you like wine a lot?
I like wine really a lot, yes.
How did your estate come together? How did it happen?
In 1994, yes, I meet a friend. It was named Karl Huber Gasser in Vienna, and he told me in 1.5 hours, what is quality by Eau de Vie?
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
He just talked to you about Eau de Vie.
Yes, we talk about Eau de Vie. He was one of the best distiller For me in Austria, he died, I think, 5 years ago. And he was amazing. It was a small distillery. He was working for another company, but his heart was in distilling all the things. And yes, he inspired me.
And how did you meet him?
There was a fair. It's the first thing like the Via Vinum. It's called, it was a Vienna fair. And I was there because I want to see something about wine. And I met him, and yes. On a place for there were 5 distillers there, and he was the guy who came to me and he showed me what is perfect eau de vie, and this was for me the start that I say now I will start distilling.
It must have been a persuasive conversation.
Yes, it was a great conversation, and I go home to my wife and I say we start distilling, and she said, you are crazy, but yes, this was our start.
So it wasn't something that your dad did?
My father makes normal agricultural, wheat, barley, oats, sugar beets, a little bit soya beans, and we sell it on the normal market, and it was not my life because quality for wheat, there was no quality. The people buy the wheat, but you don't know is it for bread or feed them, they feed the box. It was a completely different time to now.
So he owned a farm, but it was planted to grains, basically.
Yes, grains. Yes, wheat, barley, and sugar beets also, yeah.
So what did he think about your idea to get into distilling?
The first thing he said is not a good idea. Now he's my father, and he's the brain now. But now he's very happy that I have made the step.
But originally you had to kind of convince him that it was a good idea.
First it was not a good idea. Also not a good idea for my wife. For my mother was the only, she said, yes, you have to do it. If you want to do it, you have to do it.
Being a distiller in Austria, what's that like? How do you go about distilling?
If you're in Austria, the typical is for us is distilling. And I think every small farmer is distilling 20 to 40 liters a year. It's called Hausbrand. It's allowed to distill this without tax, only for using in your farm to drink it. And it's a long traditional thing, but as the quality changed from the middle of the 90s to now completely.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Maybe because of people like Gasser? Or?
Yes, Gasser. Gasser was the first. Also, Kolles was one of the first producers. And yes, we come to these producers in 1994. We started, and my first eau de vie was Per Williams. And we won the first championship in the January 1995. So, yes, Per Williams is the most selling product in Austria.
So I imagine if there's a long tradition of making it, there's probably a long tradition of buying it. There's a market for eau de vie in Austria.
Yes. I think Austria and the southern part of Germany, also Switzerland with the cherry, they call it cherry water, and the northern part of France, also in Alsace. These are the typical regions for fruit brandies or eau de vies. In Italy, they sell grappa, and they don't... Only one producer now, Capovilla, is making eau de vies, but there is the traditional grappa, and in Austria it was Rotbrandis. But see. Only from plum and apples and a little bit apricot, that was the start.
So you decided you wanted to distill, and what's the first process of that? I mean, how do you get fruit, for instance?
We have planted years before apple trees, my wife and I, and 10 trees with Per Williams. So this was the start. We started with 100 liters the first year. And then the next year we have to buy more. So we try to find good fruit dealers and distribution for fruits. And after 3-4 years, I saw all the producers buy from the same places. So we changed completely and planted now 25 or 24,000 trees now, and we produce 75% of percent. All difference, yes. We produce 9 kinds of fruit with 42 varieties.
So you already had planted apples before you decided to get distilling?
Yes, we plant apple for the fresh market, but not one variety or two. We planted 11 varieties, and this was also not easy for the fresh market because the people want to have one big player and not small quantities. And yes, we decided for this because we want to eat the best. And we thought if we can eat the best, also our clients should do this. Now we sell nothing for the fresh market. We make our productions.
But you found when you were in the market for fruit that a lot of it was coming from the same farms that the different distillers were buying from.
Yes. And there are some places in Italy, in the near of Modena, the most by there, the Per Williams, and there are some big players for cherries, and yes, they buy from these places. Yeah.
So if I were an Austrian distiller, I might actually be buying Italian fruit.
Yes.
So it's not a legal requirement that...
No, it's normal. It's legal. Also, they buy some pears from the southern part of France. Yes, in Austria, there are not so much Per Williams. I think we are one of the biggest grower for this pears, and we don't sell any fruits to other distillers. And because we need it for our own production. And yes, that's it.
And you find that the quality of the fruit can vary a lot depending on where you buy it from or whether you grow it yourself.
I think it's the most thing is it depends for the harvest. I think also in other places they grow really good fruits, but we harvest them one day before we start the fermentation. So we can choose the ripeness on the perfect, the perfect hour, but the perfect day. So this is the most thing. And also we find for our soil the right roots to grow the perfect balance for the fruits.
So is the ripeness of a fruit that you would use for distilling the same as a ripeness if you were to sell it to a market for eating?
No, completely different. If you sell apricots now, you pick them 14 days before they are ripe, and if you taste them, you cannot really taste the fine apricot aroma. If you want to have a perfect apricot aroma, you have to taste it 1 or 2 days before they are ripe. And so we harvest them 1 or 2 days before they are completely ripe. But we have no time. And we have to do it immediately, the fermentation, and pick out the fruit, pits. But you have to find some farmers who make the work for you. And that's not easy.
So it's key to distill it quickly after you pick it.
Yes, we have our fermentation time is 7.5 days, the average in the year. So we have to do it for raspberry only for 4 to 5 days, for Per William 7 days, and you have to do it very quickly, otherwise you get an oxidation. So for me, we want to find the cleanest and freshest part of the fruit. And I think if you have a perfect Per Williams, you can smell the skin, you can smell the fully ripeness pear. And I think eau de vie don't need oxidation.
So the type of fermentation, or at least the length of it, depends on the fruit. It could vary. Some are longer, some are shorter fermentations.
Yes, it depends from the sugar. So raspberry has only a small quantity of sugar inside, so it is faster fermented than an apple. Apple has a lot of sugar, so you need 5 days longer. A plum has, I think, in the moment, the most sugar inside, plum and the black cherry. And we take 12 days for fermentation because we control the temperature. We have between 17 to 20 degrees Celsius for the fermentation temperature. And if we go warmer, it goes faster, but we lose the fine aroma. So we make the fermentation a little bit cooler.
And the fermentation takes a little bit of time because of the low alcohol.
Of the low alcohol, yes. We must be complete fermented, and then we can distill. So if we go ready on Sunday and distill on Monday at 6 o'clock in the morning.
So did you find parallels in wine fermentation? Did you learn through the process of learning about a wine fermentation how to apply that to fruit fermentations, or are they totally different?
No, I think it's different, but I learned a lot of the really good wineries in Austria, because the thing we do in our company is completely different with the tanks to other distillers. We have stainless steel tanks, we have it, we can cool them, we can heat them, we have, and we see this all by wineries. I've never seen a completely distillery now. I know my distillery, and that's it.
But you designed your own distillery.
Yes, I designed my own distillery, also my fermentation tanks, my pumps, and but I saw a lot of from Austrian wineries.
What were the principles that you used to design your own distilling? What did you think about when you made those plans?
The idea is the most distilleries are built for quantity, that the people can fast distill a lot of quantity, so that it keeps it cheap for the mechanics. My idea to design our distillery was only for the quality, and we have 2 years ago planned a new one, built a new one, and we decided that we need more money for the quality than for the quantity. And that's the idea in all our doing, is the quality.
So when you distill, what do you do? Do you use all of it, or do you use parts of it, or?
We distill two times, and the first time, it's called the first run, we use all of it. And the second time, we distill the first time, the second time, we cut the head, the heart, and the tail. And this is the part where you make your quality, your perfect quality. And we cut 3 to 4% for the head and 25 to 28 for the tail.
So it matters where you make the cut.
Yes. And you can make the quality. You cut them with the nose and taste, and that's it. And you have to do it. We cut the head in the morning, every day, between 7:30 and 8:30 in the morning. So you have to taste in the morning the first eau de vie. And you cut the tail is between 2 and 4 o'clock. It depends. Is it fuller or not so full? Has it more sugar or not?
What are the different fruits all told that you distill?
We are distilling now 20 different fruits. And we started in June to harvest the strawberries. It's the first. Then we get the cherries, the sour cherries. And at last we have the apples and the quince. Quince is only for the European market. And so I think we have 24 different kinds of fruits.
And what is the easiest to distill of those fruits?
The raspberry is the easiest.
Is that true?
Yes, the raspberry is the hardest to get the perfect raspberry. But if you do a perfect fermentation, then it's easy. It's fast and easy because it's less sugar inside. And you smell the cut between the head and the tail so easy. That's easy, yes. It's harder. It's Per Williams is the hardest thing to distill, because to find the cut between the head and the heart, and the heart and the tail, this is not so easy.
When you grow fruit, is that different than growing grapes? I mean, do they react differently to weather or harvesting?
We have learned a lot also from the wineries. We make also now a green harvest by Per Williams in June, not last year because we have two less on the trees, but in a normal year, we harvest in the June 10 to 15%, and this we learned from the wineries, and also playing with the leaves so that the wind comes through the trees and so on. And but if we have a hard rain since 2014, the fruit don't get in like botrytis. The fruit don't get it. We have less sugar inside. This is our problem.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. So if there's a lot of rain, you have trouble getting ripeness.
Yes.
But you don't have to worry about noble rot or rot.
Yes. This is the reason. We have this year, 14 days later, for the perfect ripeness. And then it gets colder. You get less sugar. This was very hard this year. And we need, by Per Williams, The normal year we need 12 kilos for 1 liter, and 12 to 12.2 kilos. And this year we need 14.5 kilos, so we need 20% more fruits for 1 liter ODV. And there's a lot of costs and more work, but that's it. 2014, it was a hard year, but the qualities are really great.
And one of the things you do is you actually vintage label the bottles.
Yes, we label the bottles in Europe with the vintage. In US, it's not allowed for white ODVs to label the bottles with the vintage.
But it's all one harvest.
It's only one harvest. We have only had one cuvée. It was 2003, 2004. You know this vintage also from wine in Austria. It was a very warm year. And 2004 was a very cool year. And in 4, we had the acid. In 3, we had the sugar. And so we store all our ODVs 2 to 3 years. So we make a cuvée from 2003 and 2004. We put it on the label and we say all this to our clients. And for me, it was the best idea to do it.
And how do they hold up? They don't really change in a bottle, or they change in a bottle?
Now, if we go to the bottle now, it change if it's closed only a little. It's the same by nearly the same by wine. We are using the Stelvin. And but if you open the bottle, it changes a little bit. We have some products that get finer, eleganter, not eleganter, but it goes a little bit finer. We have some products that get more and more. For Per Williams, if you open it with the air, it gets more. And we have one or two products. You have to drink it in 1 year, one and a half year. So for a raspberry, it's better to drink it in 1 or 1.5 year, because you have so a lot of fresh flavors inside, and you lose a little bit the freshness in the nose, not in the mouth, but in the nose.
What about something like ginger that you make? What's that like to make?
Ginger was an idea from a restaurant, from a chef in Vienna. And he came to me and said, I have to make ginger. And I said, no, it's a hard work. You are the only guy to want ginger. And he said, I want to have 350 bottles. And I said, if you buy 350 bottles, then I start with ginger. So, and now I cannot stop it.
Is it easy to work with ginger?
No, it's very hard, because ginger is so intense that after distilling, we have to wash the distillery with normal alcohol to get out all the oily flavors. The same is by the pumps and so on. It's not easy. We do ginger the most time for 2 years.
Oh, so you do it once every 2 years?
Yes, then. Once every two. In the future, once every three years.
And that's because the cleanup is really annoying.
The cleanup and for the filter, for all our system, it's because 100 milliliter of ginger destroys 1,000 liter Per Williams. It's so intense.
I see. So if you mix the two by accident.
Yes.
If it went through a pump or something.
Yes. That's not easy.
Does ginger have sugar in it already, or how do you ferment it?
We ferment the starch to sugar, and then the sugar to alcohol.
Oh, I see. So it's an even more complex process.
Yes, more complex process, and we learned this process from the carrots. It's the same. And also, if you have a vodka from potatoes, this we learned it. We see it, how they do it, and then we make it for our own way.
Outside of the quality of the fruit, what really determines the quality of a eau de vie, of a finished distillate?
I think the first 50% is the fruit. 35% is the fermentation. You must be extremely clean. You must be clear. The temperature must be right. You have to control it five times or four times a day. And the last 15% is the man behind the machine and the machine. But 50% is the fruit. If you have not perfect fruits, you don't get perfect eau de vie.
For you, what is a perfect eau de vie? I mean, what does that taste like?
If you taste now the Williams, if you smell it, you smell the green to yellow skin, you smell the fully ripeness pear, and if you drink it, you have the same in the mouth. So no oxidation, fine flavor, Some people say if they smell my Pear Williams, they say it's the same. I have the pear for me. I see the pear with my eyes, and that's the idea for Imperfect Eau de Vie.
Have you found that some vintages have been more successful? Are there certain vintages of certain distillates that you think, oh, that was a great year for...
Yes, I think the best year was 1999.
In general?
For Williams and also for Raspberry. I know it mostly by this two sides. 2008 was the best year for Apricot. Also 11 is great. And now the vintage 2012 is by Pear Williams is also amazing. It's really amazing vintage. These are by Williams and by Raspberry and Apricot, you see it on the most time. By Plum, you never see really the different vintages. You see it a little bit, but you have to taste really hard that you find the different vintages.
In terms of the Austrian market, you said that there's people who buy Eau de Vie there, but, you know, I don't often see so much in the States that people buy, but yours are well represented and they seem to do well. What were some of the sort of milestones in getting the Eau de Vie sold on a global level?
I think it's not easy to sell it on a global level because you have a complete other tradition to go for a dinner. In Austria, the tradition is to have not the perfect aperitif than you have here. With the cocktails, we have a small beer or a glass of champagne first or a glass of muscatella. Then we have the dinner with the different wines. And in Austria, the digestif at last is typical for Austria and also for Switzerland. And here is the digestif is not so typical to drink it every day. And it's different, but I think the people drink it more and more, also before dinner and to go in a bar and drink it a little bit. And also this changes also a little bit in Austria. They have small, really small, two milliliters only to taste it in a bar and changes also a little bit. But I think it's not for a global market. We cannot sell Eau de Vie in the Africa and in the warm place. It's not so easy.
So it's helpful if the climate's actually somewhat cold to drink.
Yes, that's really helpful. The most Eau de Vie will drink in the mountain area.
I've often looked at you and thought it's probably helpful that you're a gigantically huge guy, like to taste so many Eau de Vie every day,
yes.
You know, without getting kind of, because if I did that, I would get kind of loopy, you know?
Yeah, we taste every day, but we spit every day because otherwise, you get drunk every day. So, but I also taste a lot of wines the whole year to see how the wineries works and also to see what we can change, what the wineries will do. And yes, we are learning every day since 20 years.
And so you won that award in 95. And did that provide a different reception for what you were doing? Did more people start to pay attention to your work?
Yeah, we won in 95, and our first clients was the best Austrian restaurant, the Steiereck in Vienna. And 1 year later, we also won this exhibition in 1996. And yes, if the first journalists come to us and write about this, so the first restaurants come, and yes, and it goes more and more and more. And in 2001, I come to the States only with some bottles, and this is the way.
How did you meet Terry Thies, your importer?
Terry Thies was in Austria for a wine tasting, and Terry Thies and Mark Hutchinson was sitting in the Wachau region.
And Mark Hutchins.
Yeah, Mark Hutchins. And they called me. They have heard from our products, and in the restaurant they stay. They have also had Pear Williams and Raspberry.
Oh, it was at the hotel.
Yeah, at the hotel. And they called me if I can come on the Monday after Easter in 2000. And if I have time to taste with these two guys my Eau de Vie. And I said, yes, I will come. And 2 hours later, I was there. And this was the start with Terry Thies.
And how's that relationship been for you?
for the quality, how they sell it, it's perfect. In the best restaurants, in the best bars, we have a quality product. We cannot sell the extremely quantities. Our product is also not cheap, and there it is, and the selection is the best way, I think, to sell it. And we are in so a lot of really extremely nice restaurants now here in New York, and as for me, I come here and I can laugh the whole day because I go there and see it, and the people have fun if they see me, if they talk to me about the ODVs, and it's a great time here. And I come here since 14 years, and it's my 28th time in New York, and it's great.
Also, you come more than once a year?
Two times in June and January.
And what was the first tasting like for you introducing into the New York market?
My first tasting was in Tribeca Grill in January 2001. And I was there with my wife. And we have had the traditional Austrian clothes, you know, Dirndl and the Steirer Anzug. And more people want to know where they can buy the clothes and not to can buy the ODVs.
People were asking where they can buy the clothes you were
yes,
wearing.
I think this was really crazy for me. And the first client was Frenchy Shot from the stage left.
Oh, okay.
In Jersey. And ordered 6 bottles with 100 milliliters. And this was our first client. And he go to Skernig, Michael Skernig, and said, he has to import this, and this was the start in New York. And my wife said half a year later, you cannot go there because we only sell 36 bottles, and the costs are 10 times more than we earn. And I said, if we don't go to the places and show our products, and then we will never sell a bottle more. And now, yes, it's a really good market for us. And yes, we are very happy to be here.
And you make some other products as well, like you make a fruit wine.
We make a fruit wine. We make an apple wine. It's with the traditional method. So this seems we make the first fermentation in stainless steel and the second fermentation 18 months in the bottle, and like champagne. And the dosage is not made with sugar. It's made with fresh apple juice. And has 7 to 7.5% alcohol, and it's also from our Jonagold. But it's a small production, but we love this product, and it sells more and more each year here. And I think we sell more than 50% in the States.
Because an apple sparkling wine, how would you use that? I mean, in what way would you serve it?
In Austria, we use it as aperitif. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it's perfect for cheese because mm-hmm. you have the acid, you have the low alcohol, and you have the fruitness. And the fruitness to the cheese is perfect.
And you make a gin.
Yes, we make a gin, and this is my oldest baby. We started 2003 with the idea from Blue Gin, and in 2006 we started with the Blue Gin. After three years, we worked 3 years for the recipe.
Oh, okay. And you worked 3 years on a recipe.
Recipe, 3 years. And in 2006, we started with Blue Gin. In 2008, we brought the first bottles here to New York. And now, yes, Blue Gin is in 34 countries now. And Blue Gin is really a high-end quality gin. And yes, we won 2 years ago the championship in Great Britain, in London, the gin championship. And if you won in the motherland of gin, the championship, that was for me the best thing we have ever had. And the Harrods in London, we were there as Spirit of the Month. And if an Austrian guy makes a gin and sell it in the best place in London, so this is the story of the Blue Gin. And Blue Gin is a traditional gin with a lot of junipers, 69%, and the rest we use to get the freshness in the gin. So a traditional but freshness gin, I think perfect for a gin and tonic and a martini.
So how did you have the idea to make a gin?
I was in the States and get the perfect gin and tonic in 2002 or 3 by Audrey Sanders in the Pegu Club.
Oh, at the Pegu Club.
Yeah. And I go back and said to my wife, I cannot drink the Austrian gins because this was, I think, Junipero. And in Austria, we have had Gordon's and Bombay and all these normal gins. We have no intense gin. And after a while, she said, you are always crying. There is no gin. You can distill, make your own gin. And I said, good. I will start. So the idea comes from my wife.
It took a long time to get that cocktail, though. It's a long wait time making 3-year gin.
Yes, you know? Because for me, the idea, gin was in this time in Europe an extremely cheap product. And the people don't recognize gin only for a cheap gin and tonic and so on. And for me, the people know me as a quality fan for my products. So if I come with a gin in 2006, it must be so great as, from the quality that the guys don't discuss it why we do this. Because if you make it normal, our customer says, yes, he's making a gin because he's making a lot of money.
Because he wanted to make money.
Want to make money. We must all make money. But the idea was to make a really outstanding gin. And in 2006, I was the first in the Europe, not in Germany and Switzerland and not in Austria. And yes, but there was no discussion. The people said, this is the new way for gin. And
nobody thought you were doing it just for the money.
Yes.
People said, this is good.
Yeah, people said this is good, and you see now what is running with gin. A lot of producers now making gin, and you can decide what is the best one. And I think blue gin is really a very nice product.
When I'm in Europe, sometimes I notice they serve gin and tonics like in wine glasses, like in goblets.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we serve it in wine glasses because I think the perfect gin and tonic is you have the gin, the ice, and the tonic. And normal in Austria, you have a long drink glass. You get 4 centiliters, I think it's 2 ounces of gin and the ice, and the tonic stands nearby. So if you fill the glass, you have a lot of alcohol because the tonic cannot go in this glass. It's too much. And after refilling, the second or third time, you get for 1 or 2 tastes the perfect gin and tonic, and at last you have a tonic and no gin. So we decided, we say, please serve the gin and tonic in a Burgundo or Bordeaux glass.
And you prefer it that way?
Prefer it that way, yeah.
What's a good tonic for you?
In the moment, Fever Tree is a very good tonic. Fentimans has changed a little bit. It's a little bit more lemon. But there are a lot of new tonics now. Some are too sweet. I think they are too sweet. But Fever Tree has a perfect balance since 2 or 3 years. And we work a lot in Austria with Fever Tree.
How would you describe the style of your gin? You said there's a lot of juniper.
Mm-hmm.
How is it different than other gins beyond quality? I mean, what's the taste like?
If you taste our gin first, if you smell it, you first smell the juniper. After 1 minute, or if you only smell the blue gin without tonic, you smell a little bit citrus. You smell a little bit orange peels and the freshness. The thing is, we have a lot of freshness inside. And if you taste it now, then it's extremely long balanced with juniper, lemon, orange peel, a little bit hops, and we have white pepper inside, and it's a little bit sharp, only a little bit, and it's extreme smooth, and it tastes sweet from the fruits. There's no sugar inside, but you have a little bit also not sweetness, but fruit sweetness, and it's extremely long balanced.
So how does it change when you add tonic to gin? What is that? How does that affect the flavor?
You have the tonic, you have the quinine, you have more bitterness, And by the tonic, you have the CO2 inside, so you get the freshness from the CO2. And you have only 10% alcohol, you can drink it easier. And gin and tonic is a typical drink. But a lot of gin and tonics, if you put the tonic inside, you only smell the tonic. And if you do it with blue gin, you smell the perfect juniper and the tonic, and it's I think it's well balanced.
And you started making a slowberry gin.
Yes, we started last year to make the slowberry gin, and because the slowberry is a really old recipe from the British guys. And in Austria, they sell all the different companies together, sell only 2,000 bottles. And because I think it's too sweet in the moment. The barkeeper don't want to have so sweet products. So, and the second idea was, if we do it perfect, we can make a summer drink also. A slowberry, we harvest biologic slowberries and press them, and we put the juice in a high alcohol gin for 6 weeks. Then we add only 6 grams sugar to it, not 100, only 6 grams sugar. And then we bring it down with spring water to 28% alcohol. So you have a perfect freshness, a little bit bitterness, slowberry gin, and you cannot taste the sugar. That's the idea. And you put it in a glass with ice and a tonic, and you have a perfect summer drink. And there's only blueberries, the gin, and a little bit of sugar. And no color from, and nothing, only nature.
Because a lot of times I've had slow gins that were much darker than yours and much sweeter from other producers. Yeah.
The reason is that the blueberries, I think the color, the most have a lot of color inside because it's so deep red or blue. And the most sweeter, yes. And I don't like so much sugar inside.
And you've moved also into doing wine distillates. So in the past you did a lot of fruit distillates and fruit wine and then gin. But now you're moving into basically brandy.
Yeah, this was, I started this 2001 only with, not only with the Austrian producer, it's named Böckel. And we make the first, we call it aquavit, it's in the nearby Grappa. And we do it from Admiral, it's a red wine from him with 80% Blaufränkisch. And by the tastings, they get 95 points, and the people love the product, but nobody buys it. Because all the guys who are drinking brandies from grapes, they drink Grappa. And in 2005, I do this also with Bernhard Ott, with Grüner Veltliner, with the 1,000 Roses. And it was nearly the same. And then I said, I think the people must know other wineries. And the idea was to show the different regions. So I try to find a lot of more wine producers from different regions. And now we are making, I think, 10 or 11 different grapes from different places, different varieties, from some vintages from France, Germany, Italy, Austria.
So it's more like a grappa in that you're using the skins.
Yes, it's more like a grappa where we only use the skins. We make the fermentation on the same day, they press it. So also from the Mersochan, from Jean-Marc Rouleau, he pressed it at 12 o'clock on Friday. And we get it at 1 o'clock, go 1,000 kilometers with the car and make the fermentation on the same day at 10 o'clock at the evening and distill it 5 days later because we make the fermentation from the skins. And we build also a machine now that we put away the stems after pressing. Because the most wineries press now, they call it, I think, the whole press with the stamps. But we have to put away the stamps. And this was hard work. And we only produce from Last year from Tesson, we produced 27 liters.
So if you had stems in with the skins, it would be a different flavor.
Yes, you get too much tannin because you have only the skin and the stem, and you get too less fruitness. So I think we have to put away the stems because there's no sugar inside. We don't need it to produce more. First, and the second is we don't want to have these flavors.
So is that why a grappa might be harsh, is that maybe they use the stems?
Yes, and the second thing is that the fermentation takes, I think, 2 or 4 months. And we start the fermentation on the same day they press it, also by Eiswein from Dönhof. This was one of the hardest things because Dönhof could say, tomorrow we harvest or in 3 days. He called me 5 hours before and say, now we have -8 degrees. We harvest now the ice wine. You have to be there in 10 hours with your boxes and with the trailer. And we go there. And it was really great, the Oberhauser Brücke.
But that almost sounds kind of crazy. Like you're on call. Like you have to wait around and have everything ready for the moment that you have to go.
Yeah, so the people say I'm really crazy and I go for the first time 24,000 kilometers.
Because that's a different country. That's Germany and you're in Austria.
Yes, it's 900 kilometers and the same was to Italy and to France. But we only produce between 80 and 100 bottles by the different wineries for 700 milliliters, and we don't earn money. We don't spend money, but we also don't earn money. But we show the guys and the different soils, the different varieties. So my idea is German, you have to distill in Riesling. In Austria, it's Grüner Veltliner. In Burgund, it's white and red Burgund. And if you distill in Austria also a red wine, you only distill a Blaufränkisch, because this is our varieties. And this year, Gerhard Kracher also want to do something with us, with his Rosenmuscatella. So we will see. I think Rosenmuscatella DBA is also a nice idea.
What's it like to do that kind of distillation with red or white grapes? Is that a very different process?
The different process is not the distillation, but the fermentation. By the whites, we do the fermentation. By the reds, the winery do the fermentation because they fermented 6 weeks, 5 weeks, 8 weeks, I don't know how long. And if they press them, we go there, catch them, and distill them on the same day. We have no fermentation because it's ready, and we distill them.
So those seem like some pretty famous wineries. How did you end up meeting up with Dönhof and Rulo, for instance?
Dönhof I know from here, from the United States. Egon Müller, we're also producing Schatzhofberg DBA 2005 and 2010. I know from a really fine store in Germany, from the Dallmayr in Munich. To Rulo, we make a wine trip. We go for a tasting to Burgund. And we go to Rollo, and he don't know us, and we was not invited. And his sister came out, and she said, Jean-Marc has no time now. And I gave her a bottle of Williams, and we go back to our car. And then he comes out and says, why we have a bottle of Reisebauer with us? And I said, I'm Hans Reisebauer, I'm the distiller. And he says, he loves our products. And this was the start with Jean-Marc Rollo. And it is a great time now. And I think he's my best French friend. Yes. And he was in our distillery 2 years ago with all his people who work for him, personal work for him. And yes, we see us 2 or 3 times a year. And I love his wines.
Because he also does distilling.
Yes, he also does distilling. He is distilling this year apricot, and he makes the apricot liqueur, and he makes it from pressed apricots and from distilled apricots. And it's really good. He also is distilling raspberries, but not with a fermentation. He is doing it with maceration, and he get this year the raspberries from me. And he's also making Pierre Williams now. And he's changing a little bit because he wants also to make really fine products. And Jean-Marc Roulot, if you distill, discuss with him, he's understanding something in a second where other people need 2 hours because he knows all these things from the wine. And he's a crazy guy because I think in his heart he's more a distiller than a winemaker.
Do you see that in the wines? Like, do you see a distiller philosophy in the wines?
Yeah, if you taste his wine, and I have tasted last year the whole series, it's so clear and so clean, and it's so focused on his soil. And if you have Luché, or you have Tesson, or you have the Perrier, or Charm, it's so different in the soil. And he's making, I don't know, 40,000 bottles or 35,000 bottles. I don't know how much, but I think he has 20 different wines because he's focused in the soil and where it is. And yes, he's really great.
When you talk about distilling, what is it that you would share with him? I mean, what would you tell another distiller by way of advice?
I don't tell anything to a normal other distiller. But Jean-Marc Roulot is different for me because I think he's more a friend than his main production is the wine, and his hobby is distilling. And if he asks me anything, I tell him all what I know. Otherwise, I don't tell anything to other distillers because I've started with nothing and nobody explained it to me. So now we have a lot of good ideas, and I think it's better.
How did you learn? I mean, through books or?
Yes, first I have a lot of luck because I get the nose and the taste.
You have a good palate.
Yes, from my mother. My mother was crazy. My mother was every time cooking for all our persons who work in our farm. And the guys go every day out after lunch and said, Frau Reisebauer is the best person who cooks the best thing, and she is so balanced between the nose and the taste. This was the first. This was a lot of luck, and then I read a lot of books, and I thought that the most was 30 to 40 years old, and I thought we have must make a revolution. It's not easy, but the idea was to make it on a completely clean and clear way. And yes, this so have we started.
And you said that you felt the 90s were kind of a change period in terms of eau de vie in Austria.
Yeah. In 1993 came the first exhibition. Maybe it's called Destillata, and there were a lot of small distilleries come to go there and have their products there. And I think the first 1 or 2 years it was really not high quality. But after the exhibition, it was a completely turning in a lot of the brain from the people. And a year later, the quality was, I think, more than 100% better. And it gets better and better each year. The problem was that the most forget the market. They produce some nice things, and then they could not sell it. Then they stopped distilling, or they try to find cheaper ways, and if you try to find a cheaper way, you cannot do in quality. So after this time, only 5 or 10 distillers, or now we can say 20 distillers in Austria on the market now, but the most are only on regional, not available in completely in Austria, and there are, I think, only a handful distillers in Austria who also are selling it to other countries.
You mostly make clear white spirits, but you also make some that have been aged in wood. And what are those, and what are those like to make?
We make apple in oak. And I think in Austria we have a history with one sweet thing. This is a apple strudel with a vanilla sauce.
Sure, so pretty tasty. If
yes. So I thought the normal thing is to the apple is in the normal way extremely fine and delicate, but the most people go to a pear before they buy an apple. And I thought the vanilla comes from the oak, so we start to age it in oak. And we do it since 1996. And now we have on the market, I think, the 2006 or 2007. It's aged 7 years in oak. And you find the, I think it's now the balance between the vanilla from the cask and also a little bit, it tastes a little bit like cinnamon. Mm-hmm. And the apple, it goes perfect. And this is one of the things we do in oak. Last year we have started with a completely new thing, orange. In oak, we distilled the first orange, but we have to wait now. It's 2 years ago. And what we also do is our whiskey in the cask.
And what's that whiskey like?
The whiskey was in, we started whiskey very early, 1995, but not as whiskey first. We distilled a beer we have in Austria. Now it's not private. It depends to Heineken now. A brewery, and they want to have that we distill them beer, and we distill them beer, and they only want to have, I think, 1,000 bottles, and we distilled 1,200 liters. And they said, you can do what you want, but they don't need it. So I said, I put it in a cask, and we wait. And the idea was not the whiskey first, because first I don't know that this what we do is whiskey. And a year later, we make the same, and I do the first barley, malted the first barley. Yes, and this was the reason in 1996 and 7 to make our whiskey. And in 2002, it was the first one we sell. And the idea was from the first day to make an Austrian whiskey. So we have our barley, we have the Austrian water, and we have also Austrian wineries with perfect casks. So I go to Heinz Fehlich, and Roland Fehlich.
Sure.
Is a
Fellinger, Artinger,
yes,
that
yes.
One.
And I meet Alice Kracher.
Sure, sure.
And I ask him if I can have a cask. So I get two casks from Kracher and three from Fehlich. And this was the start. And the idea was only to do it with Austrian casks. So 1997, we get from some casks from Dement. 1999, we get from Brilla, the Silvia Brilla, the sister from Georgi, was also making a red sweet wine one time, and we get these two casks. Now we get all the casks from what we can get from Kracher and Fehlich. And the idea is to make it with Chardonnay Trockenbeerauslese and also Welsh Riesling Trockenbeerauslese. This is Austrian sweet wine. It's typical for Burgenland. So these are the sweet wine casks. We have our barley and we have our spring water. And we have to do an Austrian whiskey because I think nobody needs that an Austrian guy makes a bourbon. We saw a lot of bourbon in the States and also not the Scottish whiskey. So this is our, it's more fruity than other whiskies. It's a little bit more chocolate. It's not smoky or only less smoky. That's the typical, different to other whiskies.
Do you feel that the Austrian water makes a difference in the distilling?
Yes, I think we use this water completely for all our products. And this is a spring, it's 15 kilometers far away from us. And they bring us the water every week two times, completely fresh. And it's so soft. It has only 1.1 German degree. And it's the softest water we have in our region. It comes from the stones, from the granite. And I think that our water makes all the products so soft because the water is so soft. And the water lives and is soft. So I think it's perfect for all the things we do. And we use every time the same.
So I see that you have done a number of different projects over the years. What should I look forward to besides the orange distillate in the next, say, 5 to 10 years? What might you be going into?
In the moment, we have done a lot of different things, but we don't stop anything. in the moment we have to look that we can all these things to do it on the market. We have some problems because for the Slowberry gin, it was sold out in 2 months. So for the whiskey, as we started, now it gets more, the people want more and more. We have to less. So now I think we have to look that all our things are really available first. And the new ideas have to wait the next 2-3 years. My son is coming in the company the next 2-3 years. And then we can do now new ideas. But all the things we do now, we must do it perfect. The clients know that if they buy something, it is extremely quality. And we never should forget this.
So your son decided to follow in the family business?
Yes. But he decided, not I decided. He decided, and now he's really on the right way. He's 24 years old. He's studying agricultural and oenology in Vienna. And he has worked by some wineries and also by a sherry producer. And I think he should see a lot of different things. And I think in 3-4 years he will come back, and then we can work together. He should work more on the market. And for me, my best place is in my distillery and to be in the orchards. He is managing the harvest for Per Williams since 2009. And that's great. And so we work really good together. And in 2010, we discussed if he want to do it or not. And he decided that for him, it was not the question, because he will do it. And yes, it's a lot of luck also for my wife and for me.
And you decided also to build a new distillery.
Yes, we built a new distillery 3 years. Now it's 2.5 years ago. And we decided together. We have started in an old farmhouse. And we have rebuilt this old farmhouse, I think, 10 times. And then I said, no, it's I cannot do this.
You redid the farmhouse, yes, like 10 times, trying, yes, to get it the way you wanted it, yeah, like add new pieces of equipment.
And yeah, all these things, new canal system, and but it was an old farmhouse. And in March 2011, we had a family meeting, my wife and my son and I, and for me it was clear, the first time, we stop completely or we build new. Our clients know our quality, and on the old farmhouse it was not easy to do it longer if you have to do a little bit more quantity. So, and I discussed it with Hansi and Julia, and the idea was to make a cheap building for 5 to 8 years, and then we sell our production. This was not my way, but it was one way. And my way was to build a perfect building for the next 20 or 25 years. And if my son will do it, then we decided this way. And he said, yes, he will be a distiller. He want to do it. And this was the reason that we decided. I think now it was the only way to do it. And we have the third harvest now inside. And you can not give me so much money that I will go back.
What are the differences? What can you do now that you couldn't do before?
First, we have place. First, we have place to work. The second is it's so clean and clear because we have the concrete. We have some things on the floor that it's every time clean. We have a stainless steel kennel system, we have the perfect electricity there, we have hot water with 90 degrees Celsius every time, every day, to every time to clean all the things. And it's, yes, completely new. And also the guys who work with me, they change completely also their ideas. And yes, it's where we produce is like a living room. So the people are happy to be there, And yes, this was really the right thing to do it. And it's mitten in an orchard. So you go out of the office and 50 meters later, you stand by the apple trees.
So looking around at the world, are there other distillers that you really admire?
I'm in the moment not really. I know not all distillers, but in Austria, I think Alois Goellers is one of the best distillers. And Vittorio Capovilli is one of the best in Italy. Fruit distillers, there are not so a lot. One German guy is in the Schwarzwald. One Swiss guy. But I don't know a little bit too less about the cognacs and the ammoniacs. But they are really some good products. But for fruit distilling is really, now it's starting a little bit also in the US here. And I hope then people do from the first moment only to quality. I think quantity is not necessary by this product, because you need the clients. And there is not the history here for the ODBs. And I think we get an history in all the different countries if we make perfect qualities. Quantities and cheap products is not necessary for any market in the world. In this world we live, for a quality world.
So no one really needs cheap distillates, really. I mean, at least you don't see the demand for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you've done so much over really not that long of a period of time. It's really only been 20 years, and mm-hmm. you've done numerous projects, which we've talked about. But are there regrets that you have looking back? Are there things that you wish you could have done or done differently?
I think when I can decide it now, what I have done the last year, I think my biggest fault was to start with the Blue Gin in 2006 and not in 2003.
Oh, really?
Yes. I think it was to do the recipe. It was, yes, it we have done it if we have time, and then we wait, we do the next, and we have tried 50 different recipes for the gin. But the 50 different recipes I would also do today, but not in 3 years. I would
you
decide
would have
to do
it in like 6 months or something.
In 6 months. So this was one of my biggest faults, I think. The other thing, no, I have my life changes completely from 1995 and to now. And I have, I think, the best job in the world. I have met a lot of guys who are discussing about wine, about good food, about good distillates. And yes, we have really, my life is really great. We have a lot of work, really a lot of work, but yes, to meet guys, you can discuss about quality. We every day discuss about quality, from the dinner, from the lunch, from the wine, from or beer, from spirits and so on. And it's really great to can do this.
But does that imply that really the Blue Gin is quite popular, that you wish you would have done it a little earlier? I mean, has it found a strong market?
Yes, if we started in 2003, and the 3 years from 3 to 6, we were really alone. And yes, this was one of the only for the business.
That's because it. Now there's more artisanal gins out
yes.
in the market.
But I think that helps us, because 10 years ago nobody discussed about gin. Now you have the discussion because there are a lot of producers. And if you know, I know my product, and I say you can decide between a cheap one or a not so good one and a better one, and you can decide to the Blue Gin, and the customer can see or can buy the better one or the best one or a not so good one. But now in the moment, I drink 2 times more gin than 10 years ago. So we have a new culture now, and I hope that it doesn't end so fast than the vodka story. But vodka has no taste, so tasted more than the filler tasted more than the vodka. For gin, you have the gin, the taste. And so I hope that also the barkeeper and all the commitment do more for the gin next time. So,
is that why you didn't get into vodka? Because you don't really like it?
There's no taste. That's the problem. We are looking every day for taste. If we go to eat or for a wine, we try to find the different things from a wine. Also, if I do my spirits, I want to find every day the perfect flavor from this food. If you taste vodka and you have 50 vodkas, I think it's very hard to say this vodka is from this company and this vodka is from this company. And it's the most vodka is really clean alcohol. So I'm not looking for clean alcohol. I'm looking for the best taste.
Hans Reitzenbauer of Austria, he's a distiller who is every day looking for a taste. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Hans Reitzenbauer, Austrian distiller. Wow, that is really good. That was my reaction when Hans Reitzenbauer poured the latest version of his Poor William for me, and then he told me that he considers this most recent Poor William to be one of his finest releases ever. That's saying a lot, because of everything Hans Reitzenbauer does, and the quality is great across the board, it's the fruit distillates that are really, really superb. I know the big stumbling block in the market for this sort of distillate is that people don't think they'll drink much of the stuff, but let me ask you a question. If you were to drink some Poor William, wouldn't you want it to be the best that is possibly out there? I mean, if you're only going to drink a small amount, shouldn't that small amount be really excellent? It should, right? Right? Or else what's the point of even trying it at all? Well, I have a great chance for you to provide yourself with the good stuff. The nice folks at Crush Wine and Spirits are offering a discount on the Hans Reitzenbauer Poor William so that the price for podcast listeners is a good chunk off of the normal. If you give Crush a special offer code, you can get a half bottle of the really tremendous Reitzenbauer Poor William for $61.95 instead of the usual $67.95, and that's 10% off. You just need to call Crush at 212-980-9463 and use the offer code IDTT for me, or use that same offer code online at crushwineco.com. Remember to tell Crush IDTTFORME when it comes time to place the order. Hans Reitzenbauer is one of the greatest living distillers on the planet today. To try some of his best work ever, call Crush Wine and Spirits and ask for the special deal available to podcast listeners. And that was our episode. Every week, we like to give you two interviews with some of the most interesting people in wine. If you'd like to support the show, one of the most fundamental, helpful things you can do is go to iTunes and leave a review, hopefully nice, thank you, that says why you like the show, but also just hook us up with some stars. And the whole point of that is, the more people do that, the easier it is for other people to find the show. The way that the review process works, if a show is popular, iTunes recommends it to other people on a more frequent basis. So it's sort of like a winner-take-all situation. If you're already popular, it will make you more popular. If you're not popular at all, sucks to be you. Basically, we're sort of in the middle, and frankly, we could use your help. So if there's something else you had planned today, scratch that off the list and give us a fine 5-star review on iTunes, please. It would really help us out. I mean, it would help us out. Also, if you'd like to purchase a t-shirt, alldrinktothatpod.com has all the information on how to find yourself a t-shirt or bag or tank top with an I'll Drink to That logo on it. And if you'd like to shoot us a donation, we would really appreciate it. It helps. And a lot of people do it, but we could always use a few more. Thanks to those who have supported us so far. It's been a great, almost, what, 3-year run? Something like that? Still doing this. Still loving you all. Thanks for listening.